Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Tim Dennison for Dave Schrader. Tuesday, folks, so we've got two shows for you today. Remember to tune into True Crime Tuesday over at Patreon. Go to darknessradio.com, click on the True Crime Tuesday banner, and be sure to subscribe to True Crime Tuesday today. Not only do we have a great story over there for you today as well, but one of the funniest episodes of Dumb Crime Stupid Criminals you'll hear in quite some time. Over at True Crime Tuesday today. Make sure you check it out. Patreon.com, True Crime Tuesday. Again, it's only $5 a month, and you get an episode, a fresh episode every Tuesday, and also you get access to all the archives. Again, Patreon.com, True Crime Tuesday, or click on the banner at darknessradio.com. That's our home site, and be sure to subscribe over there. Today's episode, I want to get right to it, folks, because we have a very intriguing episode with an esteemed guest. Paul Jeffrey Davids is our guest. He's the co-author of not only 6 Star Wars books for Lucasfilms, but he was also production coordinator and writer for the original animated Transformers TV series, which I know a lot of you grew up watching or have watched extensively before the movies ever came out. He's the executive producer of Showtime's Roswell, the UFO cover-up, starring Kyle MacLachlan and Martin Sheen. He's produced and directed 10 feature films, including The Sci-Fi Boys and The Life After Death Project, both of which aired on Sci-Fi, and Jesus in India, and the biopic Timothy Leary's Dead. And as an undergraduate at Princeton, he won 3 top writing awards, then studied under full scholarship at the American Film Institute Center for Advanced Film Studies in Los Angeles. Now, Paul is also the best-selling co-author of An Atheist in Heaven, The Ultimate Evidence for Life After Death. Might talk about that a little bit as well tonight, as well as being an accomplished artist. Tonight, we are going to talk about some fascinating stuff. He is the co-author of a book called Blowing America's Mind, a true story of Princeton, CIA, mind control, LSD, and Zen. And it's something that up until now, he and his co-author, John Selby, have been kind of reluctant to talk about. So let's welcome into Beyond the Darkness, Paul Jeffrey Davids. Paul, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Hi, Tim. Thank you. Thank you for going over my resume like that. So it takes me back to the days of Star Wars and Transformers.
Well, you know, Roswell. I know the first thing people are going to want to know, and let's just hash it out there, get it out there and throw it to the side. Are your novels a part of current Disney canon? We'll just call it Disney canon because that's what it is.
Oh, forget the canon.
Forget the canon.
My books that I co-wrote with my wife, Hollis, came out in the early 1990s. Mm-hmm. I think the publication started in 1993. So it was way before a lot of the things you've got now. We wrote the books filling in after Return of the Jedi.
Okay.
So there'd been 3 Star Wars movies up to that point. And then there was a gap of years. So then we were contracted to write 6 books while everybody was waiting for that next feature. Mm-hmm. Which was the Jar Jar Binks feature. I guess that's the way everybody remembers that movie.
Right. You know? Yeah.
But that was great fun. We got to work with artists at Lucasfilm and design the stories, and George Lucas and his licensing staff approved everything. It was a delightful time. And, you know, that followed my work at Marvel Productions on the Transformers. And there, I was aboard for 79 animated episodes.
Wow.
I was the production coordinator, and I wrote four of them too, the scripts.
Wow.
So we come a long way. I've had a long career. I've made all those movies, many of which you've mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Timothy Leary's Dead relates something to what we're talking about today, because it goes back to the psychedelic era, and we are going to talk about LSD and the psychedelics and their history and their role in society today. But Blowing America's Mind,
mm-hmm.
it's a book that we started so long ago after we finished up at Princeton. And it just never would let itself be finished through the years. It's been decades. But it had its origin in the fact that while we were Princeton students, and this was, back in the days of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, mm-hmm. we're that generation, 1967 at Princeton, all-male school, psychology majors, both of us. And we got employment at the New Jersey Neuropsychiatric Institute, which in addition to having permanent psychotic inmates, patients there, they had a Bureau of Research, and that's where we were enlisted as deep hypnotic subjects. So that's how it all began. We didn't know that this was funded by the CIA's MKUltra at the time.
No, but we got in. Before we get to that, let me set up some background here for our listening audience here, Paul.
Right.
In that, what made you decide that – now, let's keep in mind, Princeton is an all-male school at the time. What made you decide that Princeton was a place that you were going to go to school and that psychology was going to be your major? What drove you to that? Because obviously today you're a creative person, and that's not – necessarily too far of a stretch, because there is quite a bit of psychology when it comes to writing. I mean, you do have to be able to stretch and be able to turn people's emotions on and be able to bend people's emotions, and to be able to do that, you have to be able to know the human mind.
Yeah, for writing, you have to understand human psychology as best you can. But
yeah.
It's a good question. Why Princeton? Well, in those days, Harvard, Princeton, and Yale were the glory schools that everybody aspired to. Princeton was the university of F. Scott Fitzgerald, who wrote The Great Gatsby. Mm-hmm. And he started at Princeton with a novel about Princeton, This Side of Paradise. And then he went to Europe. He was there with Hemingway, and then he gravitated to Hollywood as a screenwriter. So a lot of people go to Princeton with F. Scott Fitzgerald's glory in mind, the psychology. At that time, I was thinking of becoming a psychiatrist. I was a pre-medical student. However, my great love in life was always making films. I started making amateur films when I was a kid, but up to that point, I didn't really have it in me to decide to take such a creative path in life and leave the East Coast and go to Los Angeles and try to carve a way for myself in the film business. That took time to get to that point. So Princeton was the beginning. It was and is an absolutely amazing university. I mean, let me paint a little picture. I mean, it is beautiful. In those days, it was all male. It's had a staggering number of major graduates. I mean, three of the current Supreme Court justices are Princeton graduates. And there's been a couple of presidents from Princeton, including Woodrow Wilson. And Einstein taught there. So people have high aspirations that go to Princeton. I think Michelle Obama also is a graduate of Princeton. But she wouldn't have been admitted back when I was there, because I graduated in 69, and it wasn't until the autumn of 69 that women were admitted to Princeton for the first time.
Okay.
So our book, Blowing America's Mind, I mean, it creates all that. You really will feel, what was it like to be at Princeton in an all-male pressure cooker environment, with no girl schools nearby? You've got a lot of horny men. And they don't know where to turn. And, they have mixers on Friday night where girls are bussed in from other, the Seven Sisters schools, they call them. Mm-hmm. It was difficult. So The hypnosis thing, it was, you know, that's inward, turning inward. You know, I saw an ad on a kiosk at Princeton for looking for hypnotic subjects at the New Jersey Neuropsychiatric Institute. And they talked about, you know, improving your sex life and, you know, attaining nirvana, you know, expanding your consciousness. They had all this hype for why somebody might want to explore this. And, of course, none of it related to what the real purposes of this research were about. And I didn't know then, and this is why the title Blowing America's Mind, you know, for our book, which just came out, by the way, the title is so appropriate because the head doctor, the head shrink at the Neuropsychiatric Institute was none other than Humphrey Osmond. Very, very famous guy. Now, your younger listeners may not remember Humphrey Osmond, but if they know the word psychedelic, that's Humphrey Osmond's word. He came up with that.
Okay.
It means mind manifesting. And that was his term for a certain class of drugs that includes the magic mushrooms, psilocybin. It includes peyote, which mescaline is the active ingredient. It includes LSD. It would include dimethyltryptamine, DMT, and what we know of now as ayahuasca. The drugs that are non-addictive, some of them have been used as holy sacraments religiously for centuries, particularly in Mexico among the Aztecs, the mushrooms. And in among the Native Americans, you have the Native American Church, which still uses peyote legally as a religious sacrament to attain mystical states, to leave behind the mundane world and have what is felt to be an expanded consciousness experience that puts you in touch with oneness and feelings of Well, I don't want to try to give my own description of it. But for some people, they have those experiences. Other people may have bad or frightening experiences and panic under these things. So it's not the same for everyone. But Humphrey Osmond, who was in charge of the research, was the head doctor of this program, along with Dr. Bernard S. Aronson, who was the hypnotist master. They wrote a book on psychedelics together, which was released after our days in the program, as I recall. But we didn't know that the cash was coming from the CIA. And the CIA at that time, you know, I don't want to just run on, Tim, without giving you a chance to ask questions. But
right.
I
do have quite a few, too, but go ahead.
Yeah, I am getting to the heart of what MKUltra really was and what it comes from. It was a top secret CIA effort to do mind control research. The MK, it stands for mind control. And they used drugs. They used hypnosis. There's a book that lists 139 different drugs they tested. Now, sometimes these were on willing volunteers, and sometimes they were on unwitting subjects who had not given consent. I mean, there are examples back in those days of the 1950s and 60s when they would spray LSD in a subway to see what effect it has on the passengers. They would use it in brothels. They would just go to various places and subject people to these chemicals to see what the effect was. They were using LSD. They were attempting it as a truth serum. They were also using it to sort of break down personality. They had 86 different American institutions involved. Now, think about that for a minute. They had universities, colleges. They had hospitals. They had prisons, research centers. They had 149 top secret projects. Everybody at these institutions, these hospitals and universities, is getting money from the CIA, and it's filtered through dummy corporations that have unusual names, so you don't know where the money is coming from. For example, at New Jersey Neuropsychiatric Institute, which we talk about throughout Blowing America's Mind, it was the Society for the Investigation of Human Ecology. That was the dummy corporation that money was coming in from. So a lot of the purposes of these experiments were defined by the CIA, sometimes they were a perversion of research the doctors had been working on already, as was in the case of some of the psychedelic research. And we just kind of walked into this blindly, and we, you know, we did have our minds blown from it. And our book really is our personal experience. We're exposing the things that happened. It's all real. It's what happened to us. And we haven't released it until now. You know, we've played it safe. Mm-hmm. We've had our separate careers. John Selby's written a lot of books. And I've done some very controversial movies, you know, with Roswell and the life story of Timothy Leary. But until now, I've stayed away from delving deep into the psychedelic drugs issue. But now you've got it out there for all to see and blowing America's mind.
Well, let me backtrack here a little bit, Paul, and then work our way forward. So you see this. Was it a flyer? What is it that you saw that said, hey, you know what? Come
take a test.
Yeah,
Sign up,
take a test.
See if you qualify.
Right. See if you qualify. What was it that you saw that made you see initially, okay, or what was it that kind of turned you on to say, hey, you know what? As a psychology student, one, I can kind of get into this. And two, it's piqued my curiosity. And three, you know what? Rather than want to be on the outside looking in and see how these experiments are done, I actually want to be a part of this. What made you think that you wanted to be the guinea pig versus the doctor in this?
Well, I asked around, and I heard that LSD was involved in these experiments to some extent. And I had done a lot of reading about LSD. At that time, Timothy Leary was promoting it really widely. Mm-hmm. Dr. Timothy Leary from Harvard, He had a long interview in Playboy, and of course I read Playboy every month, you know, never missed an issue of Playboy. And you know, the things that they were saying about it then made it sound like a utopia drug. I mean, Cary Grant, the actor, had undergone LSD psychotherapy, and he had touted it. It was in all the major magazines then. You had Life magazine, Look. And it was made to sound like it was something that could be really helpful at opening the mind and influencing creativity. So there was that, and then the hypnosis angle. I just thought, you know, I wanted to, you know, to try it and see where it led. And my co-author, John Selby, he had been in the program already for over a year. You know, deep hypnosis twice a week, over a year, and he was feeling some very negative repercussions from it. You know, they blacked out memory of these experiences, and then they would let the memories creep back in when they wanted to. But, you know, they were really interested in studying madness and schizophrenia and figuring out how that was different from the psychedelics. And they would put you in these hypnotic states where they would distort your sense of reality, and they'd want to see how you behaved. They'd study you, you know, like a lab rat for 4 or 5 hours at a time. And John Selby began to have, you know, I don't know whether to call it a breakdown, but he was having a lot of problems at the point where they were elevating him to staff hypnotist. And they assigned him to be my training hypnotist at the beginning of all of this. And the book gives you all of that, you know, how we met, what the friendship was, and we were so different as personalities. You couldn't have two more different people. It's like, you remember Midnight Cowboy, you know, John Voight, the cowboy who goes to New York, he meets Dustin Hoffman. Mm-hmm. And so we're as different, the New Yorker and the cowboy. I was from suburban area of Washington, D.C., and John Selby was from a cattle ranch. He came to Princeton from a cattle ranch. He had a fencing desire to be a fencer, and he rose to be one of the top fencers on the Princeton fencing team. But the hypnosis got in the way of even that. He was trying Zen techniques of hypnosis, where you put yourself Zen techniques of fencing. You put yourself completely in the present, and you erase from your mind all the rules and strategies of the European method of fencing. that, you know, the coaches want you to follow. And so he got into a lot of trouble for being trying to be a Zen fencer. And then the hypnotist flashbacks became part of it. All I can tell you is we began to put it all down way back then when it happened. So what you get in our book, what you get in Blowing America's Mind, is the freshness and the reality of how it felt, what we lived, who we knew, how we interacted. You get the Princeton party life and what it was like to be part of all that, and what it was like to have it all sort of collapse on you and turn very dark. And that was the MKUltra side of it.
I'm interested in knowing, Paul, I know this seems like an odd question, but when John was fencing and he would do the Zen method, would he at that point, because it seems like when you talk to some people who had experimented with psychedelics or have been in that moment where they've experimented with psychedelics, it's when they go to a place where they empty their mind that the flashbacks come back quicker. Has it ever happened to him where he's been in the moment of competition, he's emptied his mind and the flashbacks come back as he's in competition?
Well, in the movie business, we call it a spoiler when somebody gives away something like that about a story. Okay. We have a Zen fencing scene in the book, which is very exciting, and I don't want to tell you exactly what happens. But what I will help you appreciate is the fact that that the hypnotists at the Institute and the ones that had Selby under their wing were devious, and you know, there was homosexual interest on the part of particularly one of the this doctors at the Institute, and he was taking advantage of some of the male subjects and you know, sort of distorting their private lives. In John Selby's case, it was hypnotic conditions to turn him away from a girl that he was falling in love with. And you know, someone asked me the question, they said, you know, I thought hypnosis couldn't really be used to, you know, change your behavior about something that you felt really strongly about, like if you were in love with somebody and, you know, they thought, well, the hypnosis wouldn't work. Well, but if they hypnotically train you to become nauseous, you know, to become sick when you're in the presence of a person that you have a relationship with, you know, that'll do it. That'll do it. And that's the deviousness I'm talking about. That's the MK Ultra part of it.
Interesting.
So
let me ask you this, Paul. In relation to you saying at one point they had tried to make John a staff psychologist, is there a point where John, as he's becoming your psychologist and you're starting to go into the program, is there a point where he's showing trepidation, at least outwardly, of putting you into the program, even
Absolutely.
As he's struggling? I mean,
absolutely, yes. And that's the great drama of the book, because, you know, I'm the naive guy in the book. I walk into this, I stumble into this, and I'm thinking it's all going to be great. And he's already seeing repercussions of it, but he is wedded to sticking with it, partially because of what they're holding out to him. You know, we had the draft back then.
Mm-hmm.
Young people today don't know how fortunate they are not to have that weighing on their shoulders, that they're going to finish college and be drafted. Excuse me. So back then, you know, lots of people were being sent to Vietnam. I mean, we ended up with hundreds of thousands of troops in Vietnam, over 50,000 of whom were killed. John Selby was told that if he stayed on in Princeton, well, it was in Skillman, New Jersey, actually, the New Jersey Neuropsychiatric Institute, if he stayed on the next year and accepted a job as a full-time staff hypnotist, that they could get him a draft deferment because the work that he was doing was considered to be in the national interest. Now, that's really strange when you think about it. I mean, you'd ask yourself, why would that work be considered in the national interest? Well, the answer was it was CIA. It was CIA from top to bottom, and we didn't know it. But that's what kept him there. But he reached a breaking point. And you see that in the book. It's part of the whole drama of the book. And he warned me. He really did warn me. You know, there's that movie out now that's so popular that has the title Get Out, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he warned me, and you see this in Blowing America's Mind. You know, he warned me, you know, get out. But I wasn't about to listen then. So you see our divergent paths, two different personalities who came together for a while. We were so close. And hypnosis is kind of a very intimate thing. You know, you're very vulnerable when you're in a hypnotic state. And then we became so far apart that you would think we never would have written this book together. Well, you know, I mean, it took us, it's been like over 40 years, I think, since we actually started the book. I called up Selby, John, I call him Selby. Mm-hmm. It's actually his middle name. He writes under John Selby.
Okay.
So I called him up in January, I think it was, and I said, look, you know, we're not kids anymore. If we want to finish this book and get it out there, let's do it, you know, now while we're still above ground, you know. Mm-hmm. And we resolved, like something from our bucket list, that we would finish the book this year. And I'm so proud of us that we did. It's, we're happy with it. I think it's a terrific reading experience. You get sucked in, and some of the characters are really so memorable. There's one character in the book in particular named Pak, short for Apokolos. He has Indian roots, who was a subject at the Institute for a long time and got out. And he's just kind of crazy. He's just really kind of out there throughout the whole book. I mean, he smokes grass more than anybody else, you know, at Princeton. Turns me on to LSD in a full-blown trip, apart from the microdosing that they were doing at the Institute. And the character of Pak, he's so upset by the Vietnam War and when a close friend of his is killed there. You know, he's very depressed. It's close to suicide, but, you know, John Selby pulls him back from that. You know, all of this is in the book, and it's real. And, you know, we think of a writer like Ken Kesey. Ken Kesey wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And John Selby and I say, that's what this book is. We lived the cuckoo's nest. That's what the New Jersey Neuropsych Institute was. And you'll only find it here in this book. And you'll only see this side of Princeton here in this book, because no one has ever been outspoken like this before about things that people normally won't touch. They won't talk about it, you know?
That brings me to this next question. Why the length of time, and why did it take you so long and take John so long to decide that now was the time for you to talk about it? What was so fragile in this information, or fragile about your the way you felt about it, that made you decide that now was the time? What made you had to why did you have to build up the strength to do this, Paul?
I mean, it's a really good question. Well, the first 10 years that we didn't put the book out of work on it, we didn't know that we didn't know the whole MK Ultra story behind it. You know, John Selby had seen some files he was never supposed to see at the Institute, but we never got the full picture until about 10 years later, MK Ultra was exposed nationally. It was headline news. You know, so we're talking back to 1977, which to many of our listeners, it's maybe before you were born, but 1977, 120 boxes of files about CIA mind control were discovered in Langley at the CIA headquarters. And these were boxes that were supposed to be destroyed. Richard Helms, who had been head of the CIA, he came in, I think, around 1964, and he revved up the mind control, but he ordered them all destroyed, and yet they weren't. They were not. They were exposed. It was like the Pentagon Papers. It was like Watergate. So suddenly the public knew in 1977, 149 mind control experiments, 86 American institutions, universities, colleges, prisons, hospitals. It was a shock. The whole story was a shock. And they had, I think it was the Church Committee, the Senate Committee, Ted Kennedy was involved investigating. Helms was gone from the CIA. They then had Stansfield Turner. It was the Jimmy Carter days. And they kind of apologized to the American public, and they said, oh, we're as shocked as you are. You know, the CIA is never going to do anything like this again. This is dark history we're looking at. we're going to find those people that stumbled into those experiments, and we'll help them. We'll find out how they're doing. And, of course, they did none of that. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing was just sort of swept under the rug and forgotten. Well, so we worked on the book again. We kept working on it, and we found publishers in New York very hands-off in terms of not wanting to touch this then. And then there was a movie that came out called Conspiracy Theory with Mel Gibson.
Okay, yep.
That was the first to really take a close look at MK Ultra and its effects on people. And when the movie came out, that had sort of took all the attention, and it wasn't the time for the book. The other thing was, we did hesitate of admitting our direct involvement in all of this. I mean, you know, because, you know, I mean, we're admitting to the drugs that we did take back then. Mm-hmm. And I sort of think the statute of limitations has passed on that kind of thing.
Yeah.
However, we're reading now that LSD is making a comeback, and it's becoming popular again. Steve Jobs said that LSD, you know, helped him enormously in opening up creative pathways in his mind. And we read that in Silicon Valley, that microdosing of LSD to enhance creativity is something that's beginning to be widely spread around, but, you know, underground. So it's a valid question. Why go back all the way to 1967 to look at all this again? And part of the answer is because it's coming back. It's not only coming back in terms of the interest in the drugs. We've come away from the just say no era. Half the states in the union now have legalized marijuana in some form or another. I think 29 states. You know, you can't imagine the repression, the people that went to jail for simple possession back mm-hmm. then. Mm-hmm. So the world has changed. It's changed a lot, and I think the world is ready for our book now. We call it Blowing America's Mind, A True Story of Princeton, CIA Mind Control, LSD, and Zen. It's just published as of December 1st, and of course you can find it at Amazon, and, you know, it's both a printed book or it's a Kindle. It's easy to find. And I urge people that have always been curious about exploring these things like the psychedelics or exploring the inner mind, or people from my generation who did go through it and lived it back then, you know, the days of the Grateful Dead and Owsley acid and the creation of acid rock, all of that. It'll bring it all back in a very memorable way.
Wow, I've got quite a few questions now that crop up. But I tell you what, here's what we'll do. Let's take our break. And when we come back, I've got some interesting questions to formulate here for you, because you have brought up some interesting stuff. One of the things I want to bring up, you have brought up the legalization of marijuana in both the medicinal purposes and recreational purposes. You
yes.
brought up the fact that LSD has come back. Mushrooms are popular in drug culture now.
Yeah. So is ayahuasca.
And we've brought up ayahuasca on this program in religious ceremonies and in different ceremonies, and especially in South America. So I want to bring up what you think is more. Actually, you know what? I want to ask that before we go to break. In your opinion, what is more dangerous, the cavalier use of marijuana or the fact that or LSD? Which do you think is more dangerous in your opinion? Because marijuana these days is much more potent than it ever was in 1967.
I understand that it is. I hear stories about that all the time. I also hear about a strain of it that they sell now that's called MK Ultra.
Uh-huh. Yep.
As far as which is more dangerous, or let's say which has more risk involved, mm-hmm. I think the reason it's so hard to answer that question is that reactions to these drugs vary tremendously from one person to another. And this is something we really have to recognize. You know, there's some people who I think unquestionably are benefited by LSD. I do think that LSD opened up my creative pathways. They were already there, but I left the medical school idea behind and I forged forward and I've made 10 movies now. I've written lots of books. I've done all these creative things. And I had pathways opened up in my mind. I also had a bad experience from it that was, you know. So you can't tell how any person is going to react to any of these things. I think the best that could be said is by making the set and setting comforting, and by having people around who are supporting, the chances of having a really positive experience go up. But there are some people who can't take it, and they're going to panic on one puff of marijuana. Mm-hmm. So it's hard. It's hard to predict. I've known people that have reacted both ways, and you can call it dangerous for that reason, or you can just say it's a risk. Everything in life entails a certain amount of risk. Does somebody want to take this risk? Well, you know, I think that it's good if society makes legal channels available for people who want the LSD experience. But if they're legal channels, you know, they would have bona fide people working with drugs that we know are pure. We would screen people who want to take it. You know, the problem is all this research has been shut down for 50 years. It's been a closed door.
Right.
You know, just say no. All the money dried up. And that's wrong. That's been very destructive, and that's changing now, thank goodness.
Well, Paul, let me ask you the reverse question then at this point. Which do you feel is more medically beneficial? Which has more of a which one is more of a benefit medicinally to humanity?
Well, I think that's a really loaded question, Tim. You know, I think there's maybe now been more research done on marijuana, mm-hmm. and there are studies that show that marijuana has positive effects in terms of certain medical problems that have been documented. So it's safer to go there, and that's why there is medical marijuana now. With LSD, you know, and the mushrooms, there was very good work done even way back when, showing that when given to prisoners, then they had the mushroom experience. Timothy Leary did this research that fewer of them returned to prison after that. And also with alcoholics, I think LSD has been shown to be effective in terms of ending alcoholism. So, you know, it all needs more research. What it doesn't need is the absolute repression and fear tactics and hysteria and legal penalties and prison terms. And let's get rid of all of that and approach it as adults. Let's leave all that in the past.
All right. Paul Jeffrey Davids is our guest. The book is Blowing America's Mind, A True Story of Princeton CIA, Mind Control, LSD, and Zen. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the CIA, the government, mind control experiments, and why they took the cross-section of America that they did and experimented on them. And does MKUltra really exist in today's day and age? We'll ask our guest, Paul Jeffrey Davids, if he believes they're operating in the here and now. And if they are, was it a smart idea to release this book in this day and age? We'll ask him when we come back. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Tim Dennis in for Dave Schrader. Our guest is Paul Jeffrey Davids. The book is Blowing America's Mind, A True Story of Princeton CIA, Mind Control, LSD, and Zen. Paul Jeffrey Davids is the co-author of the book, along with John Selby. John and Paul both were part of a program at Princeton, which John, in a condensed version, was a government-sponsored program that was, would you say it was microdosing of LSD that was used
that,
to?
That was part of it. Sometimes the hypnosis was without any drugs, and sometimes there was microdosing with LSD. And there may have been other drugs, too, that we never knew.
And now, in this program, did they, other than to give you kind of vague reasons what they were using the hypnosis for, such as, you know, to improve your sex life or whatever. Did they give you an end game as to why they were doing this hypnosis? Did they say, was it to expand your consciousness? Was it to make you a better person? Did they give you specific reasons as to why they were doing the hypnosis, or was it just an open-ended study?
Well, the enticement was that they had done studies, electroencephalograph brainwave studies on yogis and Zen masters, and they felt that they had identified certain brainwaves connected with, I don't know if you want to say enlightenment, but it's the kind of expanded consciousness that deep yoga can bring after many, many, many years. And so there was the enticement that the hypnosis could lead you into these expanded states of consciousness, that basically with this training, perhaps you could attain a sort of a nirvana someone else might spend a lifetime in the Himalayas, you know, that was one of the things. They also talked about breaking down your inhibitions and improving sex life. It certainly did break down inhibitions.
Right.
On the other hand, that wasn't really their goal. They were really studying the difference between expanded states of consciousness, where there would be expanded depth perception, and differences in your perceptions that would elevate your feelings, and those that accompany schizophrenia, which would be, you know, flat depth perception, and the shrinking somebody to feel like they're 6 inches tall. They made John Selby at one point feel that he was a bird, that he was inside the body of a bird, and that he was no longer himself, and he flew away as this bird. And he didn't know what they did to him while he was gone as a bird. He felt like they took part of himself, and it never returned. And this was part of what haunted him for months afterwards, that because they blocked memory of what happened during the sessions. But he remembered having been a bird and flown away, but he felt that there was a part of himself that never came back. And he panicked over this. Those are just a few examples. I mean, it was very, very widespread, and it did get to be, you know, very dark. And it's why our character Pac in the book, you know, he's pretty messed up on the one hand, but on the other hand, he's pulled himself away from all of those games, as he calls them.
Well, it's interesting when you bring up Pac, you know, there was at one time there was research that suggested that, and I'm going to go back to the differences and similarities between marijuana and LSD. There was a study at one time that suggested that marijuana, if smoked by teens, could potentially bring about early onset schizophrenia. Or if you had the potential to be schizophrenic, it would bring it on sooner. I believe it was, again, this was during the Just Say No era, and it might have been hyperbole for that matter, that LSD could do the same thing. Now, I would ask you this. Would you believe, now you mentioned that Pac both imbibed on marijuana and both partook in the LSD as well. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that Pac suffered mental illness as a result of either of those controlled substances, or did he have it beforehand, and that either of those substances might have aided and abetted in a heightened state of mental illness?
It's a tough question. I think the research at the Institute really brought it on for him. And again, he is one of the main characters in our book, and it is a One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and he's a little bit like the Indian character maybe in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. excuse me. As far as the dangers, you know, I don't want to underestimate the fact that they can be dangerous. There are people that have, you know, set out to have a good trip and never really were the same afterwards. But on the other hand, a lot of these people never knew really what it was that they were taking or was it mixed with some amphetamine or something else? Was it pure? Sandoz was the chemical company in Switzerland that first sponsored the experiments that led to the discovery of LSD. I'll talk about that for a minute. It was
sure.
Albert Hofmann, Swiss scientist. I think it was 1937 or 8. He did all these different compounds of lysergic acid diethylamide, and it was LSD-25, the 25th compound he came up with, that causes these mental effects. He didn't know that at first. He thought it was useless. He experimented on animals, and he noted their behavior, and then he just locked it away in a drawer. And it was like 5 years later, 1943 or two, he was accidentally exposed to a very small amount of it. Mind you, 100 micrograms for most people is enough to put them on a full-blown trip, and 300 or 500 micrograms is a very significant dose, and you would be under the effects of this for 8, 10, 12, 14 hours. Well, Dr. Albert Hofmann, you know, was riding his bicycle home, and all of this started, and he didn't know. Had he poisoned himself? I mean, he had all of these mental effects, these hallucinations. He describes it really vividly in his book called LSD, My Problem Child. And one of the main things was the intensification of the sensations, of senses, of touch, of sound, of sight, of color. You know, they tell us that the brain has a reducing valve, which blocks off some of this massive amount of stimuli that comes in toward our senses and our brain all the time. And you need this reducing valve, I think it's the diencephalon, so that you can not be overloaded and make sense of the information your eyes and ears are, your sense of touch are giving you. But when that's diminished through the use of a psychedelic compound, you're overloaded with thoughts and stimuli and images. And if in the course of 5 minutes you might normally have, say, 15 different thoughts, you know, under LSD, in that same five minutes, you might have 1,000 thoughts. You might feel like you're having 1,000 different experiences, all of them intense. And so it makes it feel like time is slowed down because you pack as much into 5 minutes as you'd normally pack into a whole day. Time just, it stops. I mean, it's interminable. That 8 to 12 hours under LSD, it's for some people can feel like months. And this is why, you know, some people can't handle that. And others can, and it opens up pathways that benefit them for a very long time. And I don't know that there's any predicting of how it's going to affect different people.
I'm curious, when we talk about the benefits of what the government might get, or even the CIA might get out of putting a cross-section of America under the influence of this drug and testing it, in your opinion, when you take college students and prisoners and the cross-section that you've learned about through your research.
Yeah, and patients in hospitals,
and patients,
some of them dying.
Hospitals. First mm-hmm. of all, in your opinion, what do all three of those people have in common that they might get a common denominator out of?
Well, I'm not sure that they have anything in common. And I think that was part of the point, that in the early research, Helms put Sidney Gottlieb in charge of all these different programs. And they had certain goals, the things that they were trying to accomplish and looking for, and they didn't know how to get there. And some of the goals, for example, if you have somebody who's worked for the CIA their entire life, they know a lot of classified information, and then they're retiring. Well, the CIA would have loved to have had a pill that somebody could pop and wipe out all those memories so that if they were ever captured or interrogated or they would never reveal anything even accidentally. It wouldn't be there in their mind anymore. That was one of their goals. It's one of the reasons they might have chosen people like college students. They chose loners for some of these experiences, people who had no family ties, people who wouldn't be missed if they just disappeared. This was their search for the so-called Manchurian candidate, Could they create an assassin who would fire upon a hypnotic command, who would, you know, be a sort of a murder tool under their control? So they were looking for all of these different things, not knowing where they would find it and when, what they might get. And that's why they had a list of 139 different drugs that they were testing. It was the Wild West. And talk about being dangerous, talk about being illegal, because many of these people never knew, never consented to what was being done with them. There was the case of Frank Olson, who leaped out of a window, didn't know he'd been given a drug. There's the case of Dr. Cameron up at McGill University in Texas with his psychic driving experiments. He took people that were mildly psychologically disturbed, and the things he did to them, I mean, they were things like what the Nazis did. It just, you can read up on this. It's none of it's made up. It's all true. It's all excuse me, it all happened under MK Ultra. And Sidney Gottlieb, when he was at the end of his life, he did give an interview, and people asked him about what their goals were and what came of it all. And he said, and this could have been a cover-up, it could have been a lie, but he said, you know, really, it came to nothing. It didn't, they never found those things that they were looking for. They never found a way to create the perfect assassin. They never found a way to erase memory in a controlled way. And so the MK Ultra program was apparently at a certain point stopped after it had gone on for decades, mind you. I don't think it was until into the 1970s, and it started in early 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
But they kept changing the names of the programs. I mean, they had Operation Mindbender, they had MK Delta, they had, I mean, the offshoots of the program must have had 20 different names. They had things going on at Montauk. I'm sure you've heard a lot about the stories of mind control experiments at Montauk.
Yep.
There have been the reports of the military lab experiments, where this might cross into the area of alien abduction experiences, where people recover those kind of memories. But they say, but wait a minute, the military was involved when I had this experience. So I think if it continues today, there's no saying that it doesn't, but I think it's changed form completely. I don't think it's experimenting on LSD with college kids anymore at all. You know, I think that in those days, there was a lot of interest in surveillance, like using people's telephone, the plastic wall phone that you had that you dialed. And there were reports that those had transistors put into them at a certain point so that they could use them as listening devices. And they would urge you to get a lot of telephones, have one in every room. Well, it gave them a way they could listen into every room. Now, the spying devices, everyone's got one. We carried around in our pockets. It's called, a cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
These cell phones that have their microphones, they have their navigation, they can always tell where your cell phone is.
Yep.
Just like they can tell where your car is.
Mm-hmm.
They could read your emails. They can read your texts. They can listen to your conversations. Through this digital world, they have access to everything. So from the point of view of the intelligence networks and the spy world, they like to tell us that, oh, no, your data is protected. Right. Well, who believes that anymore? It gets hacked every few months, right, by some rogue element. You hear about how they got 20 million people's social security numbers. They hacked them. Sorry. It's a wild, crazy world we live in today, where the government, the powers that be, they can know anything they want to know about anybody. So they don't need to do it in the same way that they used to do it, of sort of this one-on-one basis where they'd expose somebody to a drug and try to control them. They have control over everybody through through television, through cell phones, through all of the accoutrement of modern living that is the technology that we all love and accept. I guess pornography is another example worth mentioning because, in the old days, it was forbidden. You had the Hays Commission ruling on what could be shown in a movie. You couldn't show a married couple in a bed together. In the 1950s, they had to be sleeping in separate beds. Look at the world today. There is no censorship. Everything is shown. Everything is accessible. And they say they try to block these things from access by kids. Well, they're not blocked. You know, through internet search, anyone of any age can be exposed to anything. So is it good? It's a vast social experiment with consequences we can't see, but it tends to be controlling. The pornography is controlling. It can be addictive. It's like a drug. And now marijuana, much more freely available, and we don't know what the overall social effects of it will be. Driving under the influence, well, I don't know. Have we heard about a big increase in car wrecks and car crashes in states that legalize marijuana? But I don't think so, but I'm sure somebody will be studying that.
I'm sure. Well, let me ask you this, Paul. And I want to go a little bit further with the MK Ultra thing, and I want to tie it a little bit more into conspiracy theories, because as you mentioned a few minutes ago, it seems like MK Ultra had ended sometime in the 70s or 80s, but it had offshoot programs.
Yes.
Now, when we see a tragedy or some sort of mass shooting or mass calamity in today's society, it doesn't take very long to go onto social media, and immediately there's a conspiracy theorist that says it had to be MK Ultra. And I'll point to even the Las Vegas shooting as something that within maybe half an hour, there was people on Facebook or any social media site that were saying had to be MK Ultra. Let me ask you this. As someone who was part of a program that was directly involved with MK Ultra, do you believe that it's even possible that for a program that they said, you know what, we tried and we couldn't quite get the technology right to control somebody through through chemical means to create the perfect soldier. Do you really believe in this day and age, in 2017, they've gotten the formula right to the point that they could create a mass calamity like the Las Vegas shootings, the festival shootings?
Boy, Tim, it's a really loaded question. You know that, right? You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, no matter what answer you give. But with something like that, I mean, first of all, fact, we don't know for sure what the motivations were, right?
Right.
Fact, there's many, many, many more questions about that shooter than there are answers.
Sure.
And the picture is murky and it doesn't add up. Going back in time for a moment, I know it was revealed that the Unabomber had been part of an MK Ultra program. There are those that had said that Charles Manson was. I don't know where the rumor and speculation leaves off and the facts begin. It's really hard to say. But I do think that you'd want to ask yourself the question of motive in each case. I mean, if you want to say, well, there was a mind control operation, but what was the motive? Who stands to gain what by having a mass shooting of innocent civilians? We know in the case of the so-called Islamic extremists, they say what their motivations are, and they're political or religious. But as far as our government, what does the government gain by having chaos among its citizenry? I think the government, which is supposedly founded on protecting the domestic tranquility, I think the government has a really strong interest in promoting domestic tranquility. You know, they don't want revolutions. You know, if pornography keeps the masses, you know, quiet and behaving. You know, they want people behaving
right.
and following the rules and things to be orderly. They're interested in business and keeping commerce working. So you got to look at the motivations before you jump to a conspiracy theory, I think. And if you can't answer that as to, well, why would somebody want to do it? You know, I don't know.
With that being said, do you believe that maybe some of these acts that are happening, some of these calamities are happening, might be some MK Ultra programs that have gone awry? That maybe it may be some people who are experiments that might have gone off the rails. Maybe they have been subject to some of these chemicals, and maybe it didn't mix with the brain chemistry quite so well. And they're rogue agents. Maybe they just couldn't handle the experiments and have gone off on their own and are operating on their own. They're not operating with a directive, but they've just not been able to handle the chemicals.
You know, you'll admit that speculation.
It is speculation.
I'll admit that there's no way to say that that couldn't happen. On the other hand, if you look at post-traumatic stress disorder as a cause of some of these things, you know, that can be an explanation in and of itself, that people who experience horrific things in war and come back to our society and can't integrate into it again as a normal functioning individual, that they are suffering. You know, something inside them is warped, and so going off the rail, it's hard to explain. It's something that needs to be studied more, because all of our lives are now in jeopardy and at risk from these assaults, these blind assaults on innocent people, women and children, people in churches, you know, absolutely heartless, and shows that there are people who place absolutely no value whatsoever on human life, including their own. And, you know, for me, I'm a person that places great value on human life. Mm-hmm. You know, and of 50 people that might be wiped out in one of those incidents, whether it's in the United States or Britain or France or wherever in the world it happens, you never know who among them is the next Einstein or the next Picasso or, you know, the next great dancer or singer, or you don't know what beautiful things are being destroyed and beautiful people are being destroyed. And for those that think that, I don't know, I could go on and on. I should cut it off there. It's really tragic. It's a dangerous, dangerous world we're living in now, but I guess it's always been dangerous, maybe a little more now. You know?
I guess the reason I bring that up is to bring you full circle around to this. You mentioned that you felt you might have gotten some positive benefits from the program.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, do you feel, and I know what your answer may be as far as John goes, but do you feel mm-hmm. that you yourself might have sustained some negative connotations or negative effects from the program? Not so much a PTSD, but do you feel that maybe this program has had some negative effects on you physically, mentally, as you've gotten further into your life? Do you look back on your life and say, you know what? Had it not been for this chemical involvement into my physical stature, I probably wouldn't have behaved this way, that way, or that way negatively.
It's a tough question. Very, very difficult. I think the fact is, and you'll see this in the book Blowing America's Mind, which I encourage your listeners to read. I mean, you can get it on your Kindle. You can it gives so much, and so much of what I'm trying to say now is better expressed there because we worked on it for so long. But at that time I was part of that program, it did get to a point for me where I became very depressed and I wanted out, just as others who had been in the program wanted out. And I don't want to give away the whole story of the book, but I did get out. But where it helped me, I think, where all of that that I was involved with back then, including the psychedelic drugs, I really had it in my heart to be a creator of movies from the time I was a child. And it was always what I wanted to do, but I got very little or no reinforcement for that from the world I was growing up in, which was very straight-laced. I mean, academic, my father, famous college professor, my mother is a teacher. The world I grew up in, you became a teacher or a doctor or a lawyer, or you took a steady government job, and that was a sensible way to live. You know, but saying that you have creative talent and you're going out to Hollywood and you're going to try to be a filmmaker, that was not only not sensible, that was considered crazy. I mean, when I made that decision, my mother called up my aunt and said, you know what, he's throwing his life away. It's, you know, and you know, the irony is I became really successful, really, really successful. I got to make so many movies and write books, and my children are both in the business and they are successful. My son, my God, he has been the digital effects supervisor on 40 major Hollywood movies, and he's not even, you know, he's in his late 30s. It's kind of amazing. But I was warned against doing this. Now, it was that period of my life when I was at Princeton and was part of the hypnosis and did have LSD experiences where I felt like I tripped very, very far away from the life I was supposed to live. And I could see myself living the life I'd always wanted to live. And I asserted myself. At a certain point, I said, you know, I've passed all of the pre-medical requirements. I finished all the courses, even organic chemistry. I've got high scores on the pre-med boards, but I'm not going to apply to medical school. I'm leaving Princeton, and I'm going to Los Angeles. And I didn't know anybody out there. I didn't know what my path would be, but I just felt I'm going to do it. And then I had a really great stroke of good luck, Tim, if you call it luck. Mm-hmm. That year, in 1969, the American Film Institute had just set up its Center for Advanced Film Studies in Beverly Hills in a colossal mansion called the Doheny Estate. And they set up a program where they were only choosing 15 young people from around the entire world, because they did have international students as part of it too. They were going to give full fellowships, and you'd study film there, advanced film studies, for 2 years, and then maybe make your way into the business. Well, out of all the people that applied, and there were hundreds, I was accepted in the first year of that program. I was one of the 15.
Hmm.
You know, and it was partially on the strength of the fact I'd been making movies since I was a kid. I'd won some movie making contests. I had written papers on how to improve traveling mat special effects in Hollywood and new things to explore to improve the technology. And I won a lot of writing awards at Princeton. And I think that my writing really got freed up too from, you know, the hypnosis, the psychedelics. I found a freedom, and I won the F. Scott Fitzgerald Award at Princeton for writing. You know, I talked about how the fact that F. Scott Fitzgerald was a student at Princeton was one of the things that was part of the dream of why go there. And I won the award given in his name. So then from that depression I had leaving the Institute, to leap from that to Los Angeles and find myself one of 15 students handpicked, and we were treated like the young royalty of the film business in those 2 years. We had the doors of Hollywood were open to us as far as access to all the top people of the business came to the AFI. They came to the Doheny Estate at that time, and we learned from them. We had mentors. George Powell was one of my mentors, the great George Powell of War of the Worlds and the Time Machine.
Mm-hmm.
And George Seton, who wrote A Miracle on 34th Street about Santa Claus. He was one of my mentors. And certainly Forrest J. Ackerman, the editor of Famous Monsters magazine, was one of my mentors. And
wow.
You know, I think that you and Dave had me on your show, and I talked about my Life After Death project.
Yep.
And An Atheist in Heaven, the book I wrote.
Yep.
And this was my reasons why I felt that I was still hearing from Fari Ackerman after he passed away. And that became a major part of of my life. And it wasn't fantasy. It wasn't hallucination. These were things that had evidence attached to them, events that happened after he passed, and things that happened in the presence of witnesses, and some things that were filmed. And yes, it made me believe that there was a spirit world and that we move on to something afterwards and there can be a bridge between the worlds. So it's a long-winded answer, but I don't think there was any lasting setback to me from having been a part of this. I think I learned from it. I did suffer from some aspects of it, but I don't regret having done it.
I got an even more interesting question for you here, Paul. You mentioned your children who are creative as well,
yeah,
and are in the business and doing well. So this is going to seem like a really messed up question, Paul.
Okay.
Do you believe with the chemical experimentation and that was done by the CIA, this is going to be a roundabout question here.
Okay.
Nature, nurture, or chemical, or a little of both? Do you believe that the LSD might have tampered a little bit with your DNA and maybe nurtured the children along a little bit and opened up their creativity a little bit? Do you think that maybe some of that chemical compound could have been passed on to your children?
I don't know. I'm not enough of a chemist, and I'm not a doctor, and I'm not a biologist, and don't know enough about DNA. But I do know this, that because I had the opportunities opened up for me, and for example, in 1994, I was able to be the executive producer of Showtime's movie Roswell, mm-hmm, about the aliens. And we had Kyle MacLachlan and Martin Sheen and Dwight Yoakam. We had a great cast. Terrific movie. It's become kind of a little classic. And, you know, my kids were on the set of that movie. You know, my son was there to see, you know, the alien coming to life in one of the scenes. And when I filmed Timothy Leary's Dead, my son was on the set and he participated in some of the special effects even then. And I enrolled my son in a class. I think he was in sixth or seventh grade. The American Film Institute had an adult class to teach rudimentary special effects like wire removal, like how you would make Superman fly. And I got permission for my sixth grade son to join this class of adults using the Mac to learn special effects techniques. So he's precocious because he's exposed to all this stuff as a kid and learns. And he far exceeded in that class what the adults were doing. I mean, it was astonishing to see him even at that point, because the teacher would give an exercise and we'd all be starting it, and I didn't know the Mac very well, and I'd be stumbling all over the place. And my son, Scott, would raise his hand, and the teacher would say, "What do you want, Scott? You know, do you need help?" And he'd say, "I finished." He finished. Took all the wires out so Superman could fly. "What do you mean, finished? You know, it's been like 15 minutes. "Yes, finished." You know, he was precocious, you know, and my daughter was precocious at artistic design. She does the posters. She's done many, many movie posters for the years. And now for NBC, she designs their ads for the television series. And she's done movies, posters for Woody Allen, you know, the Foreign Cat in the Hat poster. And some of her posters have been billboards in Hollywood. So that's what I kind of attribute it to. But, you know, if I hadn't have decided I was going to have the creative lifestyle, then my children might not have, you know. Mm-hmm. I did a presentation on this, Tim, a PowerPoint presentation. It was like a lecture presentation. It was just at the StarWorks USA conference in Laughlin, Nevada. And it was called Living La Vida Loca. You know, living the crazy life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's what I put together. All of this stuff I'm talking about tonight, how it amounted to living the crazy life, but it's been a good life. It's been a great life, and it's been a successful life. For me, all this craziness, it worked. It doesn't for everybody, but the pieces fell into place for me, and I've gotten to do all these projects that people get to see and they know.
I've got one final question for you here that's going to seem like an odd tie, but in a way, it all kind of comes together in a weird, fascinating government conspiracy. Now, you've been the subject of a government LSD experiment where they've taken chemicals, used them on people to see how they react.
Yeah.
The one that's really been the talk of the town the last decade, even two decades, has been chemtrails. Using chemical trails up in the sky to either influence weather, influence people's behaviors. I want to ask your opinion about it. Do you believe, as someone who's been subjected to LSD trials or microdosing, do you believe that our government is actually using chemtrails to influence our behavior or even weather patterns?
Well, I don't know about behavior. I've read some articles that it may have been conceived as an effort to stem off global warming by putting particles in the upper atmosphere that would reflect some of the radiation coming through. I don't know. I don't think anybody's got the final answer on that, but I do veer toward the conspiracy theory on that one. You know, you could sometimes tell if they're hiding something by how they try to dodge any questions about it. You know, it's like with the Roswell case, with UFOs, you know, they shut up. They spend so much time denying, right? So much time denying. But if you talk to the same people about ghosts, you know, they're not afraid to talk about ghosts.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
But UFOs, yeah, there's something there. Alien visitation, yeah. There's something there. I've heard it from top astronauts. Yeah, I subscribe to that. And as far as the chemtrails, so many people have tried to get Congress to look at it and look at the data and look at the evidence, and they just won't touch it. So that makes me say, yeah, there's something going on there. They won't talk about it, that they don't want us to know about it. And I don't think it could spell any good for anybody. So there you go.
The thing that made me, I guess, take a second look at it, although I do have my future brother-in-law has worked at an airline before, and he's adamant about the fact that chemtrails are nothing but contrails. But and we have that argument at every family gathering. But
you can see the difference when you look up there. The usual contrails, they disappear pretty quickly. They don't just sort of billow out and spread out, you know, and make these crisscross patterns that stay up there in the sky for hours. You can't tell me it's the same thing as an ordinary jet contrail.
I'll have to
get, it isn't.
To get his answer and bring it to the air. Over Christmas, we'll talk again, and I'll get his official explanation. We haven't argued enough for me to memorize it.
There are more learned people about it than me. But the
thing that got me to change my mind was actually seeing the video, and you can catch it online too. It was an interview with Michio Kaku, and it was a local news crew that was talking about when they were talking about weather control, and he said, "Oh, we're doing it right now with a simple laser. We're able to seed clouds with a simple laser." And at that point, the news crew cuts him off, which is weird because, you know, and it wasn't the point that they cut him off. It was the fact that he said, "We've been doing it since the Vietnam War." And we've been doing it since 1967. And he starts to go into it, and they cut him off like toot sweet, like boom, like, no, nope, yeah, that's okay. You know,
Michio Kaku, he's one of the great ones.
Yeah.
He's one of the great minds of our modern era.
Right. And when you cut him off I think it was because, one, you're talking over a local news crew's head. You know, and they don't want to get too far into it because you are talking over their head and they don't quite know how to come back with it. Two, timing reasons, of course, on a local newscast, you've only got so much time to wrap that up. But I think it was more, you know what, you're over our heads here and we don't know how to deal with you at this point. But the third thing is, what are you going to unleash here on the air that we can't deal with?
Right. And I wonder, I wonder what I'm unleashing here with blowing America's mind.
Exactly.
It's a brand new book, and we haven't heard all the repercussions yet. I haven't heard the reactions of the people at Princeton. We did just have a half a page ad for it, a beautiful ad come out in the Princeton Alumni Weekly, the current December issue. So there's 100,000 Princeton alumni who are going to now know there's this book about a true story of Princeton, CIA, mind control, LSD, and Zen.
Well, let's talk about that real quick before we leave people tonight here, yeah. Paul, because this isn't exactly a rosy trip down memory lane for Princeton, and it's not a rosy trip down memory lane for government officials. Do you or John have a fear that now that this is out there, that you've put this out, and it's not exactly a small publication, you're kind of going for broke here. Do you have any fear of any repercussions? Does John have any fear of any repercussions, either from the college or from
Tim,
government officials? Or
we're too old to have any fear for it anymore. It's 1969 is when I graduated, and I used to dye my hair brown, so I'd fit in with all the young people in Hollywood. And this year I stopped, and now I'm a white-haired guy. So fear, no, I think I have to be one of the outspoken trailblazers. That's my responsibility now that I'm a senior citizen. And I think I'm doing a good service here, and I hope your listeners will read Blowing America's Mind for many reasons. But one reason is simply this. We put about 40 years into writing this book before we released it. And we're talented guys. John Selby, he's written about 40 books and Seven Masters, One Path is one of his renowned books. Many, many books. He's written philosophy books, psychology, self-help, some adventure stories. And I've done all these controversial movies. We put a lot of thought into this. And I think we've made the book a really, really good ride and also a fun ride. I mean, it's got a lot of humor in it, too. We were college kids, and all of that college kid stuff, from the locker room talk to hunting for girls, it's all part of it. So I think it's become a piece of literature, and I hope people will take the time to read it. I really do.
Well, I believe they will, Paul. Again, the book is Blowing America's Mind, A True Story of Princeton CIA Mind Control, LSD, and Zen, written by John Selby and our guest tonight, Paul Jeffrey Davids. Paul, thank you very much for joining us tonight and enlightening us about that era and about the things that were going on there. And again, we encourage people to go out and grab that book. Amazon.com is where you can get that. And again, we have our killer links there at darknessradio.com. You can reach out to Amazon.com and get Paul's book there, Blowing America's Mind, because it is quite the read and quite the entertaining read at that, and informative read.
And we have set up a website, blowingamericasmind.com, where we're trying to provide the latest information on psychedelic research.
Oh, very cool. Well, yeah, check that out as well. Blowingamericasmind.com. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Paul, for being with us tonight. Appreciate it.
Tim, you're a great interviewer. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. And folks, join us again tomorrow night for more Strange and Supernatural here on the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.